Oil itself is a very kind of seductive material. It promises you wealth and convenience and all of these things I spoke about, productivity, speed. But at the same time, it's destroying you and killing you and destroying the earth, but you can't somehow reconcile those things together. And
herzlich willkommen zu Kunst in Berlin, dem Podcast der Berlinischen Galerie Museum für Moderne Kunst. Mein Name ist Thomas Köhler, ich bin der Direktor des Hauses. In diesem Podcast treffe ich Künstlerinnen, die bei uns ausstellen und Menschen, die die Kunststadt Berlin prägen. Wir sprechen über moderne und zeitgenössische Kunst und die Arbeit in einem Museum. Kunst in Berlin wird präsentiert vom Förderverein der Berlinischen Galerie. Dear friends of Berlinische Galerie, welcome to episode number 22 of our podcast Art in Berlin, another episode in English. My guests today are the artist Monira Al-Qadiri, who has just opened her wonderful solo exhibition, Hero, here at Berlinische Galerie, as well as the curator of the exhibition, Ann Bitterwolf. Monira, Ann, I'm still filled with excitement from the wonderful opening we celebrated last week and exhausted. Great to have you here today.
Lovely to be here.
Hi.
Well, first question to you, Monira. Berlinische Galerie is collecting and presenting art from Berlin. You are born in Dakar, Senegal, hold Kuwaiti nationality, and received your education in Japan. You're a global citizen, but what exactly brought you to Berlin and what made you stay?
Well, I think Berlin is a city of artists. I mean, I think I read somewhere that it's up to 8% of the population works in the creative industries. So I feel like it's a city that's made for us somehow. We have a great community of artists here. Anything I think of, I can collaborate with people. It's just a great environment to be in as an artist. But I don't know if it's going to last like this, to be honest.
Okay. What makes you think that?
Berlin is suddenly becoming very expensive, and I feel like we're being slowly but surely replaced by the tech industry. So it's a bit worrying, but we'll try to see what happens.
Okay, so you think the network of artists is an important factor to move here?
Yes,
as an artist.
I mean,
did you know anybody?
I know hundreds of people
before
I came here. Yeah, artists, musicians, writers, you know, it was called the Arab capital of Europe. It's so many artists and people from the Arab world live here. So we already have kind of a community between that and people from all over the world, really.
And one of your galleries is based in Berlin.
Yes.
But still, the show at Berlinische Galerie is your first institutional exhibition. What does it mean to you?
I mean, it's a huge kind of milestone for me. I've never had a museum show in Berlin, the city where I live. Yeah, it was amazing to be able to kind of invite friends for the first time, people I know, other artists, also people who work with me. My team could come to the opening. For me, that was really special to be able to hold an exhibition in the place that I actually live. Yeah.
So, Ann, you have been working with Monira for a while on the show.
Yes. Actually, our history started in 2021 when we showed some of your works in the video space. And after that, I always had a look at what you're doing, of course. I saw your works at the Arsenale during the Venice Biennial. And also, you, Thomas, as well as me, went to Bregenz to see a solo show there, which was really impressive because this is not the easiest building for exhibitions, I would say, even though it's so pretty. And you somehow managed to really have a very cohesive show from the ground floor to the third floor. And yeah, we were really impressed by it. And so we invited you to Berlinische Galerie to have a bigger show.
That's a very good keyword. I think the architecture in Bregenz, because I think it is very dominating. So did they have many rules for you, which you had to follow?
No, actually, it was really a carte blanche, just do whatever you want kind of situation. Just don't drill the floor.
Uh-huh, okay.
But it was very kind of, up to the artist. You can do what you like to do. And as you said, the architecture was very dominant. But I tried to create works in that space that kind of use the architecture as a kind of stage for the work. And I think I managed also to do that at Berlinische Galerie, to be able to use the space to complement the work rather than to diminish it.
I think you even had an idea for the floor in Bregenz.
Yes.
Can you describe what you exactly did to the floor? Because it looked very, very expensive.
It was. But the top floor, we had the whole floor became white. And it's a special material, basically, that you pour on the floor and you can peel it off. And
well, I haven't been to Bregenz since. Could they peel it off?
Yes, they could. But it was very magical in a way that, you know, it became like a kind of dramaturgy from the ground up. You could go through these different stages of the exhibition and also my ideas around the works. And I think it was very successful. And I try to replicate that experience in many other shows after that. Hmm?
Well, their floor became white, ours became red. Can you remember the process?
Yes, I remember the process. I mean, we invited you and we sort of gave you a carte blanche too, I hope, even though there's some restrictions for the building. And you proposed an idea. And I think we started talking at the end of 2022, so it's quite a long time ago. And then our show got postponed a bit and there were different budgets. So it was a process. But at some point you came up with the idea, which we can see now, to deal with petrocultures, which we've done, which you've done for many years now, but with a focus on an oil tanker. Yeah, maybe we'll start with that. Maybe you can talk about how you became interested in the ambivalences of petroculture and why you've been working on this for such a long time.
I mean, it's a topic really that I've worked on since 2013, so more than 10 years now. And it just keeps coming back kind of as a kind of obsession. I think of oil as being this genie or monster or alien that's kind of part of my life. It's taken over my body. It's taken over my mind. I'm kind of abducted by it, as we all are in the world. And I'm just trying to kind of reflect that in many different ways. But I feel when I was making these works more than 10 years ago, nobody really paid attention. They thought it wasn't relevant to them, that it was some kind of a distant topic, whereas now it's very much in the forefront. And I mean, as we spoke about the exhibition, I went to the space multiple times, not knowing what I will do there, because it is very intimidating. It's huge. But it's narrow at the same time, but it has its very high ceilings. And it's quite a tricky space for an artist to work with. But actually, I worked on this piece called Gastromancer, which you maybe saw in Bregenz, which is these two seashells, red seashells. And the whole work was actually about the paint, this reddish burgundy paint used on oil tankers that makes these seashells change their gender. And so I went back to this subject and this idea around tankers, and I thought, oh my God, that's what I should do here. I should make an oil tanker that fills the space. And of course, I thought, you know, all different kinds of ways to make this happen. But then I thought I should just use this massive wall that you have to create a painting, almost like an advertisement of a tanker. And so it was a very risky, I think, work. You know, it's not a painting that I've seen before. It kind of materializes in the space while they're doing it. So I didn't know how it was going to turn out in the end, even though I designed it and worked on it. But I think it was successful in the end, even though it was very, very taking a huge risk, I think.
Did you have any form of consulting? Because executing such a big work, I mean, requires preparation and technical knowledge. So did you have to ask anybody? Do you have a studio?
I have a studio in Charlottenburg. I have a team working with me. So we actually contacted so many people for this because I wouldn't be able to paint it in 5 days or whatever we had slated for it. So I talked to a lot of people, street artists, people who paint buildings from many different places, actually. But in the end, we found some Argentinian artists living in Berlin who do street arts, but painting, because also you had a restriction about spraying inside the museum. So it was quite a tricky kind of maze to find the right person to do this, but it worked out in the end.
Yeah, worked out really well, I would say.
Yeah.
Maybe we have to describe a bit what we can see in a show because not everyone has seen it. So We have this huge mural, which is 25 times 6 meters, which is still only a tenth of the size of a real tanker. But what else do we see? Could you walk us through the show?
In the first space, when you enter, you see a series of light boxes, which is a work called SS Murex, which is actually the only work in this exhibition that isn't commissioned by you. It was an older piece. But I thought it was interesting to use as a kind of introduction, almost like you're in a boat looking out into the sea from a window. And the works are around the subject I told you about, seashells changing their gender. Murex seashells, so all the boats are called Murex. And then slowly but surely you walk into the space and you see this huge red carpet and the 25-meter mural on your right. And on your left side, you see these tiny model boats of oil tankers that almost look toy-like. And they start kind of close to the ground and then they start floating and flying up into the air. And in the beginning, maybe you don't notice, you know, they just look cute and fun, but you start reading their names and then things start getting stranger and stranger. So they're almost like a floating poem of sorts. The work is called Seasons in Hell, and it's based on the poem of Arthur Rimbaud, A Season in Hell. And so the boat names are actually fragments of the poem adapted into kind of titles for the boat. So, and then in the front, you will see a huge red sculpture, very huge. I feel bad I made everybody hang it on the wall because it's so huge. But it's the nose part, front part of the oil tanker called the bulbous bow. And it looks massive in that space, but actually it's still a miniature compared to the real thing. And it's painted in this very shiny car paint that makes it look very sleek and almost fast and speedy because that's what this nose is made for. It's made for efficiency and speed. And I thought it's a perfect kind of emblem of kind of capitalist society that we're so obsessed with productivity and efficiency and speed that it's almost like a growth or a tumor in our kind of collective body that we don't know how to excise, you know? And then at the end of the exhibition, there is a new film called O Body of Mine, which actually I came up with very late kind of in the process of coming up with this exhibition. But I was researching a lot about oil tankers and I discovered that the used ones or the ones that are decommissioned are kind of disposed of or discarded on a beach in Bangladesh called Chittagong. And so the film is actually a footage from this place with a poem also by Rimbaud called The Drunken Boat, which is very interesting because it's a poem written as a boat in the first person. And this boat is very depressed. It's living in despair. And I thought it was the best kind of metaphor for this whole problem. But also, I wanted it to be at the end of the exhibition, after you see all the color and kind of the flashiness of the show, that you would kind of sink back into kind of this dark reality that we're living in.
You talked about Rimbaud. Maybe you could talk a bit about what drew you to his writing, but also, generally speaking, what interests you in poetry and how poetry is used in your sort of visual practice.
I mean, I think it very much comes from my background. I think my work is very hyper-visual and kind of colorful and sculptural and also kinetic and animated in a way. From basically my growing up in Japan and having this Japanese background and education there. But also, I think the literary aspect comes very much from my being as someone from Kuwait. I think the Arabic language, the main artistic form of that is language, is poetry. It's not visual, it's audible, it's sound, it's writing. So I think my work is a combination of these two very disparate kind of cultural influences, but they kind of come together in my work. And yeah, I think my work is very much kind of trying to create emotional landscapes for people. So either through sculpture or poetry or sound or visual, like there's always these different elements. And there's a very huge, I would say, kind of storytelling aspect behind it. So there's always a story behind the story behind the story. And it's very important for me. Even though I'm not a writer myself, my work is somehow writing stories.
But when you do write and you've rewritten this poem, do you write in English or what language do you write in usually?
I've made video works in Arabic, in English, and Japanese. It depends, really. The language is also part of the work. So sometimes I use Arabic on purpose, and sometimes I use English on purpose. It's the way I want people to experience the work differently. So it really depends on the piece and how it's constructed.
When you decided to study in Japan, I think it's not a very obvious decision in the time when you, well, made the decision. The Western countries are so dominant in the art world, but you decided to go to Japan. A completely different context, different religious background, different culture, a very isolated culture for a very long time. So how did you get into that? And did you learn any Japanese? Have you been learning before going to Japan? Because I think there's a huge barrier between someone who's not used to that culture.
My obsession with Japan started actually during the war in Kuwait in 1990. I just became obsessed with Japanese cartoons. I was 7 years old, a child, and I really kind of found my escape in that universe. And I thought that, you know, I had an epiphany at that time that I will go to that country no matter what. And, you know, I started teaching myself Japanese, and it was just an obsession that this is my aim and this is my goal. And then I made it happen. And I moved there when I was 16 with a scholarship in 1999. And I learned Japanese very quickly. I think I was so in love with it. It just was, came to be very naturally. And also I was very young. And yeah, I guess the rest is history. I lived there for 10 and a half years. I studied there. I lived my, let's say, adolescence, early adulthood there. So it's really part of who I am. After 10 years, of course, I became very disillusioned with the place because it's not an easy place to live, especially as a foreigner, as a woman, as an artist. There's many things that are not very accommodating to those things in Japan. But even if I wanted to get rid of it, it's stuck there. I'm somehow changed, you know. And this is why I also see myself as an alien. And the character of the alien is very important to me because I'm always an outsider. I'm not a Kuwaiti anymore. I'm kind of looking at it from the outside. I'm not Japanese. I'm looking at it from the outside. I always have this outsider gaze. And I really embrace that. I like being an alien in the world. I'm definitely an alien in Berlin. Yeah.
So something that really distinguishes your work and that interests me is that it's visually very appealing. It really seductive. It draws you in. You have often spectacular surfaces, as you said, with the car paint and great colors. And then when you look at it, it also has a really subversive side, like a critical side. Is that something, is that a strategy you started using right at the beginning of your career? Was there a moment when things changed for you?
I mean, I really started using this kind of, let's say, element of trickery when I started working on the topic of oil, because I feel like oil itself is a very kind of seductive material. It promises you wealth and convenience and all of these things I spoke about, productivity, speed. But at the same time, it's destroying you and killing you and destroying the earth, but you can't somehow reconcile those things together. And my work is very much about that. It's shiny and enticing from the outside, but once you know what it is, it becomes darker and more difficult. And so it's supposed to be beautiful and disturbing at the same time.
I think this is something you can also say about this show, because as you said, in the beginning, it's very attractive and you want to go in. And then in the end, you see this really sort of dystopic video footage. Well, also, I mean, most of European ships are being destructed in the so-called global south, and we sort of export all the problems that go with it, all the danger and the hazardous work. Could you talk about the sort of formal aspects of this video? Because you use drone shots, which gives it its sort of, yeah, dystopic quality. Could you talk about that?
I mean, strangely enough, people who were in the opening, some people didn't believe that it was real. It's that disturbing to them that they thought I somehow made it with AI or 3D modeling. And it's just funny to me that, you know, people don't even believe kind of the destruction that is existing in this world right now. It wasn't shot very long ago, you know, just 2 months ago over a day. I didn't use any AI or 3D or anything. It's real life, but because people don't want to see it or even don't want to believe that it's happening, it somehow becomes unreal to them. And I thought that was really interesting, actually. I tried to go to Bangladesh to shoot it, but I need a visa and I need permissions and I need all these things. And I just managed to find a local film crew who said, we have a drone and we'll go and shoot it for you. So that's how it happened. And when they sent me the footage, I was in disbelief because it was so surreal. I didn't expect it to be that, let's say, crazy and magical at the same time. It was really shocking and beautiful at the same time. Yeah.
While we were putting up the show, the war between Israel and Iran began. So all of a sudden, your topic got a very, very frightening aspect. And what did you think when this started? Because it's the West in general is very vulnerable when it comes to oil. Everything can like break down.
Exactly. I mean, this is the crazy thing, right? I mean, when I started working on this exhibition, you know, it was a year or 2 years ago. You know, these things weren't kind of in the news yet. And somehow now it's like, I feel like the show is mutating all the time, depending on what's happening in the world. But at the same time, I mean, it's very relevant. Suddenly these tankers are in the news every day, you know, and we're looking at them and seeing them. And until now, they were somehow kind of invisibly floating in the background of our lives, even though it's such a giant industry. I mean, the show is really also about the politics of scale, that the scale of this industry is so enormous that as like lay people in the world, we never kind of can fathom how big it is, you know? And I think the video at the end really just reveals a very small part of how massive these things are and how many thousands of people it takes to put these tankers together and move the oil across the world. And if you look at the size of the human beings in those videos, they look like ants, you know? And so the idea is to make this kind of play with scale. The model boats are so small and tiny and make us feel almost like a divine gods looking down at these tiny boats. But then at the end, you're also kind of humbled back into being this tiny, tiny cog in this giant machine that we don't understand anymore, you know?
If I remember it correctly from the press tour you gave together with Anne, didn't you tell us that in the beginning the tankers were named after Shell's?
Yes.
I mean, one of the biggest companies is called Shell. So that's so sarcastic in a way.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? That there's this huge fleet of oil tankers that are called the Conch and Murex and all these names of seashells. And there's hundreds of them. And it's just because of, you know, the family business and its history of being a business around selling seashells for kind of fashion items. And then it morphed into kind of an oil business. So for me, it's, all of these histories are very interesting. I don't like to also shy away from them. You know, I had a show in Houston, Texas, which is kind of the center of the oil industry in America. And a lot of people didn't enjoy my exhibition. They felt that it was critical towards them. But I thought it was interesting. I like to go kind of into the belly of the beast and, you know, ruffle a few feathers. There's nothing wrong with that. And my work isn't really about kind of, it's not didactic. I'm also just reflecting the status quo. It's really about showing people what's happening in the world and reflecting it, even though it's dystopic and crazy. It's not, you know, I'm not telling them you have to change the world. I'm actually maybe allowing them to wallow in their misery as well. You know, it's not just about kind of a positive message of change. It's also about kind of being melancholic and sad about what's happening in our world.
Yeah, and the power of oil. I remember when I was a little boy in the 70s, when we had Sundays without cars because OPEC had decided to raise the prices considerably so the West couldn't afford oil anymore. So, but all of a sudden, the cities were empty. And I mean, public life almost broke down. And I think this was quite an interesting experience that you could bike on the highways. You could even have a walk on the highways. Today, it looks to me like an utopian idea of a better future.
Yeah, I mean, the oil shock is really interesting. Whenever I come to Europe and I say I'm from Kuwait, people always talk about the oil shock and what happened. And I was even in Amsterdam in a residency at the Rijksacademy, and all these Dutch people, you know, a little bit older generation, would come up to me. They say, we have a song about Kuwait during the oil shock, you know, and that's why we know your country, you know. So it's really interesting to me that there was a moment in time where this was used as kind of political leverage, which seems to never have happened again. But it's interesting to me. Like, yeah, we are so vulnerable and we are so connected to this substance. Sometimes when I show my work in Europe, I feel like people have this distance and they're like, oh, oil is your problem. You're from Kuwait. I'm like, no. It's all of our problems. We just don't want to think about it, or, you know, confronted somehow. I feel like people are always shying away from this very kind of dirty subject that's like the elephant in the room, basically.
And there have been very different reactions to your work from different cultures. Is this something you can really sort of put into boxes and say, oh, this culture always reacts like this and these people always react like that? Or is it more diverse?
I mean, my work has a life of its own because I also make films and videos and I've shown them everywhere. And I really don't understand how people can react to my work. I also work in art and public space, and that's a whole nother animal by itself. But this topic itself obviously is treated very differently. In Europe, it's more like people look at it through climate change and kind of an ecological lens. And when I show it back in Kuwait or Dubai or Saudi Arabia, people have much more kind of existential kind of angst towards this subject because it kind of it threatens their existence somehow. So I feel like, and like I said, in Texas, it was very interesting. A man actually walked up to me and said, do you know that oil is renewable energy? And I said, what? And he said, you know, after we die in 200 or 300 million years, we will also become oil. So it's renewable, right? So I thought it was also interesting that they are using kind of the key words that, you know, that are used in kind of the ecological movement to make oil more friendly or more palatable somehow. So yeah, like I said, everywhere is very different. You know, also, I show my work sometimes in Canada, and they have a huge problem with these tar sands and kind of oil extraction from rock, which is a very different process. And Norway as well, I've shown my work there. So it's interesting that everywhere treats it very, very differently.
And you're currently preparing a public sculpture for the Central Park in New York. This is also about oil.
No, actually. It's about ancient Egypt. Which is a subject I've been obsessed with since the pandemic. And I've been trying to actually make this sculpture happen for a while. But strangely enough, it's also about kind of our relationship to nature and the earth and kind of the ecological topic. So I see it as a natural progression of my practice, but maybe people will be shocked when they see it. And it will stay in Central Park for a year, so I know New Yorkers can be difficult and they might not like it.
Okay, this might become your general running time of a show. And that's going to be Central Park South, I guess, southeast
yes.
corner.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, it's going to be up for 1 year, yeah. Like the show at Berlinische Galerie. So I wouldn't say that everybody has to hurry up to see it, but it ends sooner as you think. It's up until August 2026. And, well, I want to thank you again for accepting the invitation of Berlinische Galerie, because the international factor and the international aspect is so important to us to have you in our museum. That's so wonderful. So leading back to Berlin and Berlinische Galerie and the start of our conversation, we always ask our guests for their personal Berlin recommendation for their weak spot at the end of each episode. Munira, are there any places that you'd like to point out? Secrets?
Secrets. Not really. I mean, I really have a lot of places I like to go to in Berlin, but strangely enough, I live in Charlottenburg and I love Charlottenburg Palace. I love it so much. I have been there so many times. It is such a strange and surreal place. And actually, not a lot of people living in Berlin actually are drawn to it. I mean, maybe the tourists go there. But it's a weird, weird place with all these very strange rooms and, you know, the Kaiser's helmet and also a dining table made of this, almost made of glass with all these objects on it. It's very magical and strange. And, you know, the time that these things were made is not super long ago. So it just shows you also how different life is now and how it was then. And I love history and historical subjects. So I highly recommend people to go to Charlottenburg Palace.
That's a wonderful idea. But you know that it was supposed to be taken down after the war?
I read this. Yeah.
Exactly. So, yes. Well, no danger now. But still, it's a good recommendation. Thank you. What about Anne?
Well, I always like to go to Spur Initiative in Köln and also Cinema Transtopia in Reading. They're two institutions who do such relevant and important work. So I'd like to recommend that. And when thinking about culture in a broader sense, I was really struck by the collection of Vladimir Karalev, which he showed at the NBB Gallery like 2 weeks ago or so. That would be my recommendation for now.
Okay, well, thanks a lot for your recommendations. Thanks a lot for being here and for talking with me today. Monira's exhibition, as I said, Hero, will be on view until August 17th next year. Please do stop by. Es lohnt sich wirklich. Danke fürs Zuhören.
Thank you.
Vielen Dank.